It's episode 13 and you're very welcome to the Insight podcast. Louise and I have just been discussing how we can have the chats when we have no news.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky and you're not supposed to complain because apparently that's bad for everybody's buzz. So I'm generally out of things. It's a nice day.
It is a nice day.
Yeah.
Lovely day. Two sunrises in a row.
Mm-hmm. I also found a garden centre that was open, which I think wasn't supposed to be open, and managed to buy a eucalyptus plant. So that's been pretty exciting too.
That is exciting. Garden centres are open.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I was getting away with something. That's very
funny. No, no.
Refertively going around like criminals in between the hydrangeas and the pine trees. Bamboo.
The black market. Yeah. Anyway, we better get on with it. Later on, we are going to be talking to Derek Green and Geraldine Meaney about the platform research initiative Cultural Analytics.
And then we're going to have a word with Stephen Behan, who's going to tell us about the very exciting Moving Well, Being Well project.
But first, we're going to talk to Dr. Georgiana Ifram. She's an associate professor at the School of Computer Science in UCD, and she's an Insight-funded investigator.
I'm part of a couple of different research centers, but I will focus on some of the work we do at the Insight Center for Data Analytics. So with my team there, we focus on developing data analysis techniques and predictive algorithms. And we focus in particular on what is called time series data. So this is any type of data that is collected over time. It can be sound, it can be video, it can be motion. So there's all sorts of applications where you can collect this type of data. So one example is automated assessment of human movement, where you have someone either wearing a phone on them or a smartwatch or a sensor placed on the body. And they might be freely moving, but more often, at least at the current state in research right now, they are asked to execute certain movement tasks in a lab. And then there is a coach with them or a mentor that guides the execution of the movement. And what we are trying to do with this, by collecting this data, is we try to automatically assess whether the movement is executed correctly, you know, and this would have an impact on whether a rehab exercise, for example, is executed correctly and will lead to the desired outcome. So these are some of the type of techniques we focus on. And of course, they are related to physiotherapy and health outcomes. They are related to kind of sports and coaching outcomes. So this would be the more application-oriented side of our work. For this, so I'm a computer scientist, and so are most of the people in my research group. But we are really fortunate that at Insight we are co-located and we work with so many great researchers from other areas. And one such example is Professor Brian Caulfield. So we work quite a lot with his group, and we are co-supervising PhD students together. And it's almost ideal collaboration because he has a background in physiotherapy and sports science, and his team has expertise in data collection and how to formulate all this data collection and assessment tasks from the perspective of sports science and physiotherapy. And we have expertise on analyzing all these data sets that are collected in the lab and developing the algorithms to understand the movement and assess the movement. So it's a really great match in this regard. It took us years to realize this, but I think now it's finally happening. So yes, we joke often that me and Brian, at least when we used to go to UCD, are side by side, you know, door to door. But it took us a while to get talking and realize all the possibilities. But now it's happening and it's very exciting.
Was it Insight 2 that brought that collaboration together, or when did you actually make that connection?
So we actually started working together in Insight 1. And it really helped that we had these regular seminars, you know, the weekly seminars, and we'll mingle and just discuss with each other, you know, what's happening. But it was really Insight 2 that it started taking wings. So it was more towards the end of Insight 1 and really Insight 2 that we are co-supervising a student. We are working with a couple of Brian's former PhD graduates that have gone on to start a startup. And we are also applying for other grants together. So it's really taken off from there.
Can I ask about the research you were talking about in terms of rehabilitation? What stage is that at? It sounds like a massive challenge when you're talking about, you know, sort of micro movements and, you know, the angle of a knee to do an exercise correctly, for example. How close are we to seeing this kind of technology being put into practice on the ground?
I would say it's coming closer to the actual on the ground part, but We are not yet there because a lot of the data is still kind of collected in a controlled environment in the lab. And I think we advanced quite a lot in training algorithms over that kind of data and developing the predictions, deploying them in an app that you can use on your mobile phone. But the real challenge is to collect the data in kind of a free living context where you're moving about your house and, you know, the data goes to a cloud or to an app on your mobile phone. It gets analyzed and you're getting back a report, or your coach or your physio gets back a report about the free living movement. So we are not yet there. That's still very much being researched. And I'm working with Brian on another project called Mobilize D, where the whole scope and goal of the project is to collect data in a free living scenario and analyze it and see how far you can go in terms of analyzing this type of movement and giving useful feedback to users.
When you were talking about monitoring the movement around the house, that sounds like something that could be quite useful in terms of an aging population, you know, enabling people to live independently for longer and that kind of thing. Is that what you have in mind, or are there other applications I'm not thinking about?
So there's certainly one application used to even understand falls, and if you're looking at different types of groups. So there's certainly, in this project I mentioned, Mobilize D, there's a collection of data for healthy adults moving around in a free living scenario, but there's also for different disease groups. So you're trying to understand, you know, is there a reduction in mobility depending on the type of disease group or the stage at which you are? And in terms of what to do with that information, it can trigger an alarm to your, you know, to your GP or to your practitioner, whoever looks after you, or to the hospital that is looking after you, possibly to the family, depends on the type of setting and the privacy aspects. But certainly we are looking. So once you can do this analysis and assessment and give back a report or a prediction for the type of movement and how it impacts that person, you can imagine a lot of different applications and a lot of uses for this kind of techniques. But there is a lot of work done on this already, in particular targeting elderly populations. But the real challenge is getting people to actually use a sensor, you know, getting people to carry their phone around. So we are talking at the advanced technology level, but actually user acceptance is a big, big issue, right? And one thing that's very interesting to me is that even I leave my phone around the house, but I always wear a watch. You know, this is always with me. Even when I sleep, I only take it off to take a shower. And I think in terms of this watch is developing a lot more capability to monitor your heartbeat and your steps and everything about your movement. Hopefully with something like this, it will become easier to monitor movement where it makes sense and, you know, the person is happy with that. And all the data collection analysis hopefully can happen even on the fly, even on your watch, actually, that could trigger, you know, a call for something. The person has fallen, or there is a reduction in the amount of movement or something like this in terms of kind of home care settings. Of course, we can never replace a human carer, right? But it can make it easy in this regard.
It does strike me that this technology could be quite transformative in this drive to move care and medicine into the community, you know, this move to sort of be less hospital-centric. Like, is there communication with the HSE, the Department of Health, these sorts of things? Are they aware of this kind of research that's going on?
So there's always a challenge, you know, communication between different, even, you know, if we are only looking at researchers, different disciplines, it's always a challenge. But when we take, you know, multiple public bodies and hospitals and universities, it's always been a challenge. But I think it's getting a lot better. And I can give you a couple of examples. So a lot of the PhD students we train within Insight and other SFI-funded centers, they typically do an internship as part of their PhD program. And we have an active movement for these internships to have direct impact, for example, by placing some of our students within hospitals, such as the Mater hospitals and other hospitals in Ireland. And at the same time, hospitals are becoming a lot more aware and proactive in the way they collect data, thinking about having data scientists in residence, thinking about having data teams and being aware that they need training, they need all these computational skills, they need all these machine learning skills, data analysis skills. So there is a lot more movement in this direction in the integration. And we are actually talking between among the centers about, you know, what are the really good opportunities we have students trained in computational skills on this side, and we have hospitals with a lot of data and very interesting questions and high impact problems to be solved. And we are a lot more proactive in putting the two together. And there is also a lot more awareness, which also helps in terms of data capability skills. And I know there's a lot of press coverage for AI, both the good and the bad aspects of AI. But this also means there's more awareness on what we could do with these skills and what we could do if we ask the right questions and have access to the data and the person with the right skills. So there is, I think there is certainly a much more proactive movement in bringing the different communities together.
And then we're going to have a chat with Stephen Behan, who's been working on the Moving Well, Being Well project, which looks at fundamental movement skills in primary school children.
We know primary school kids and adolescents are not active, okay? So we know from recent studies that only 17% of primary school kids get the recommended 1 hour a day of physical activity. And we know that adolescents even less, like 10%. And that's actually come down since 2009, 2010. So all these initiatives that have been ongoing, but they're not working. So what we tried to do was look at the underlying causes of why are children active? What motivates them to be active? Why do they want to go out and play, basically? And what we did was we looked at their physical literacy. So physical literacy is a term that's thrown around an awful lot at the moment, but it's very, very simple. It's basically three parts: motivation and confidence, knowledge and understanding, and physical competence. So all these things match together. So you can imagine that if you know that running, for example, is good for your heart health, then you might be more motivated to do it. And if you're more motivated to do it, then you might get a little bit more confident in it. And then if you have that physical competence, if you're able to run properly and you know you are, that can increase your confidence. But yet also, if you start running more, you're going to get better at it. So all of a sudden, that confidence. So it's this sort of a cycle. And what we found was that the research around the world is telling us that this positive cycle can start at a really, really early age, but equally a negative spiral of disengagement can happen at an early age, that they may step away from physical activity at an early age, and that has negative health implications as they go forward through life.
And Moving Well, Being Well itself was a massive, massive project. How did that even come together?
So how it started was I obviously had connections with the GAA, but had a meeting with Noel O'Connor and Sarah-Jane Belton and Johan Issetel in the School of Health and Young Performance. And we decided, yeah, definitely, this is something that we need to do. So once we got moving, we performed one of the largest data collections of its kind in the whole world in terms of a research project at this scale. So we collected over 2,000 primary school kids' data from right around the country. So what we wanted to do was to create this snapshot of Ireland's Irish children. So we collected fundamental movement skill data. So that's our basic movement skills. We looked at physical fitness. We looked at other health indicators. We looked at their confidence, their motivation. A colleague of mine, Cameron Pearce, he's from a psychology background, and he would have looked at body image and self-efficacy. And we looked at teacher questionnaires. We looked at parents' questionnaires in terms of their own activity. And we were basically trying to get as much information as we possibly could and trying to see what fits where. And we sifted through all that data and we looked to see, can we actually make a difference now? Can we intervene? So what we did was we developed this intervention, which basically worked on children's fundamental movement skills. So these are the basic building blocks. So if you can do these basic skills, you can link them together to put them into any various sport or activity that you wish. We used the GAA coaches that are going into the schools anyway, and they delivered these classes based on fundamental movement skills, but they also upskilled the teacher as well. So all of a sudden, it's a half an hour where the kids are improving their skills, they're having fun, it's non-sport specific, so everyone feels included and they feel like that they should be taking part. And then the teacher is able to repeat that class because they have now got some new knowledge and a little bit of help from the coach. The fact that Insight were involved meant we were able to collect all that data. So all that data was pen and paper previously. Okay, so with the help of the team in Insight, we were able to develop an app. So all these things allowed us to do it on the scale at which we did. And I suppose that's what has made the project so successful.
Can I ask, when you did the initial assessment of where the kids were at, what were the findings then?
Yeah, great question. So I'll break it up into a couple of different parts, I suppose. So I've mentioned fundamental movement skills a couple of times. So these are our ABCs. Okay, we don't teach a kid to read by giving them a book and say, off you go. We teach them the alphabet, the sounds of the letters, etc., etc. Same for movement. We talk about the fundamental movement skills and then being able to link all those skills together, which allows us then to take part in whatever activity we want. Okay, so we looked at those first, and what we found were really, really low. And I can't stress enough how simple these skills are. They're really, really basic. We're talking about running, jumping, hopping, catching, kicking, simple stuff. And 75% of all the kids that we tested can run properly. Okay, so you might be thinking, oh, that's actually not bad, 75%. But that means 25% can't. That means one in four children can't run properly. Now, bring it back to that spiral I was talking about. Imagine that if they can't run properly, how many activities does that preclude them from?
So what does that look like, not being able to run properly?
So for example, having the opposite arm to you. So if your left knee is up, your right arm would be up. Think of a screenshot of Usain Bolt when he's sprinting. His left knee will be driving up and his right arm will be driving up. It's just that bilateral coordination, right? So there's one thing. That's one criteria for the run. So it's really, really simple things. And if you go, I guarantee you, people might be thinking, oh, this sounds really complicated. I guarantee you, I could show you 20 videos of people running and you could all pick out the person who's not running properly. You might know why, but you'll know that they're not running properly. But then you go into the kick and they're not confident in the kick or the catch, okay? They're not confident in jumping. All right, think about all the mainstream sports that we promote, and they're all fantastic, but we promote Gaelic games and soccer and rugby and basketball and all these various different, and athletics and all these various different things, which we see as mainstream sports. But if the kids don't have those basic skills and we ask them to do those activities before they build up that confidence and that base skill level, well, then we're starting off from, it's like the analogy with the book. We're giving them the book before they can do the alphabet. So our whole plan is that we give them these basic skills. They can master these. They can link them together and they can take part in whatever activity they want. The project's in conjunction with the GAA, but it's not about getting more people to play GAA. It's just getting people to be active and to giving them a toolkit to be active for life if that's what they want to do.
So you found that the level was reasonably low among Irish kids. Did the intervention help then, or has the research gotten to that point?
Yeah, so many of the listeners will probably know that publication takes time. So we have several papers that are under review at the minute. But yeah, the intervention did help. It was an eight-week intervention, and it comprised of a 30-minute class that I mentioned earlier. The GAA coach would go in, deliver the class, non-sport specific, fundamental movement skill based, and the teacher would then repeat it before the coach came back. Coach comes back, goes to the teacher, okay, how'd that go? Brilliant. Anything that didn't go so well? Okay, we'll work on that today. That would go on for 6 to 7 weeks, and at all the time, the coach would be taking that little step back and the teacher giving more autonomy. The in-classroom activities and the home activities as well. And so the first trial we did that was with about 500 kids. 250 kids we ran the intervention with, and 250 we didn't. They were the control, just tested pre and post. And what we found was nearly a 20% increase in the kids' movement skills between first test and the second test. And the control group, there was no change, no significant change. We also found a slight increase in confidence over that time as well. But what was really interesting, so we left them alone for 6 months and we went back 6 months later. And the intervention group continued to grow and increase and improve. Now, the control group did improve as well, but not at the same rate as the intervention group. So whether that was that the kids just kept developing themselves, whether the teacher had more confidence to help increase, we don't know yet, but we're working on it. But what we do know is that it's working. We've trialed it with more than 1,000 kids, and all the results are really positive, and we're tweaking and changing it. And actually, we have a short project going on at the moment where we're developing the in-classroom activities. We're developing those a little bit more because in the current climate, getting outside for PE, etc., is difficult. So trying to get that movement in the classroom. So we have a series of videos that we're producing here in DCU. Very lucky to get use of the teaching and learning, the green screen studio. And we actually have got Muntor John from the After School Hub to come in and to do the videos for us. So basically, it's going to be like another teacher at the front of the room in the classroom and take them through real simple activities like push your chair in, can you stand on one leg, can you do it with no hands, can you do it with your eyes closed, and progressively we'll get a little bit more adventurous and have a bit more fun. That's the plan.
Wow, potentially transformative, isn't it?
That's the plan, that's the plan. Small steps, but everything we do, I suppose, because we were able to collect that data on such a large scale and because we're continually collecting data, that allows us to stand over everything as being data-driven and evidence-led.
Last week, we completed our series on research challenges, and we have decided to continue with the theme by taking a few of Insight's platform research initiatives and exploring them a little bit further. Professor Geraldine Meaney and Dr. Derek Green are leading the Cultural Analytics Platform Research Initiative. We decided to ask them all about it.
Cultural analytics is probably a phrase that many people haven't come across before, particularly if your background is in computer science or science in general. Generally refers to the analysis of large cultural data sets using computational and visual techniques. When we talk about cultural data sets, it's a very broad church in terms of what we mean here. This could be anything from digitized collections of texts, so you know, historical documents or books dating back several hundred years, to things like census records, or to more sort of contemporary data like image, audio, or video collections. And in many cases, these data sets are you know, important from a cultural or, you know, they cover a significant topic or event. But because of the scale of the data, there's a real challenge in analyzing them at a what we'd call a close reading level. So, you know, analyzing them manually, you know, document by document or image by image. And this is where the analytics aspect of it comes in. You know, as a computer scientist and as a data scientist, these data sets provide a really interesting challenge because of their diversity, because of their richness and complexity, and it means that you know we can do some really interesting things from an analytics perspective, but also, you know, from my perspective, it gives me a great opportunity to collaborate with people from other disciplines as well.
I suppose that's the crucial part of it. It's a dialogue. It's a collaboration between data analytics and humanities. My specific expertise is in literature. So Derek and I have worked on other projects over the years where we, for example, did social network analysis of fiction, looking at the way in which people in the past have imagined their societies and what that can tell us about, for example, attitudes to migrants, attitudes to women, to people of other classes, other races. And one of the things which cultural analytics does is it allows us to answer very big questions. I should say it allows us at this stage to ask very big questions. Answering them will take some time. But for example, the project that we're working on at the moment is looking at 35,000 volumes from the British Library 19th century corpus and looking at attitudes towards migrants from other parts of Europe into Victorian Britain within that context. And so working with Derek, I can do that at a level, or as a team, we can approach that at a level which traditionally in literary scholarship, you would be looking at maybe four or five authors. Because in order to do the depth of research, you would actually have to limit your corpus to that extent. So you'd be trying to pick who is most representative. And when you do that, you miss a lot of, for example, what's going on in the popular culture at any given time. You miss the more immediate responses in popular fiction, but also things like serials and magazines to newcomers like Irish and Jewish migrants in the East End of London in the late 19th century, for example. So taking a cultural analytics approach allows you to look at a much larger group of texts, but it also allows you to look across history in ways which were completely inconceivable even 15, 20 years ago.
Sorry, now this is a very basic question, but are you choosing words, phrases? I'm assuming you're analysing text, so how do you decide what to look for even?
Well, this is where the dialogue comes in. There's two ways. The one is that you allow this corpus to talk to you. And that's where data analytics is so important. So there's 35,000 volumes in there. Around 7,500 are obviously fictional works. There's a broad selection of topographical works, some history, you know, some text related to local government. So it's very, very diverse. So we do pick within that. I mean, I'm obviously focused on fiction, on the novel, because I think it tells you a lot about how people imagine themselves in the world and how that changes over time. So on the one level, you have a ground up, so you can topic model and see what are the topics within that very large corpus from the past, which is now opening up to us. And on the other side of it, you can go in and search and look for particular topics. I mean, we did some interesting work over the last couple of years on attitudes to disease, which has suddenly become very topical again, and contagious and epidemic disease particularly. So we went searching for particular diseases and associations, say, between contagion and epidemics, attitudes around smallpox and smallpox vaccination. So we went looking for specific things. So you need that dialogue between allowing the corpus to speak to you and then looking, deep diving, looking for particular things and seeing where you can find them. And often what you find is quite unexpected when you're able to go into such a large corpus as that.
And do you think that if you're looking at history in a new way with new devices and you're picking up bodies of information that perhaps weren't visible to us before, and it tells a different story than the story we've been telling historically. I mean, I know history is a moving target anyway, but how do you make sure that what you're finding then feeds into the corpus of what people are being taught, for example, in schools, or is that way outside of your remit?
No, not at all. And I think that's a really important aspect of culture and analytics, that at the moment a lot of that dialogue is going on at a very high level. You have academics talking to other academics. And really the first stage is to get a much larger group of people who work in literature, history, and the more traditional humanities to start taking a data perspective, and not to be intimidated, not to think that's not what I do, because actually at this stage, we're all using digital tools. We're all using data sets. Every time you look in a library catalogue, you're using a data set. So I think the first thing is to have that kind of professional dialogue. But I also think there's a really important piece of work to be done in terms of data literacy, and I'm very interested in critical data literacy, so that, you know, the average school student needs now to be able to realise that a Wikipedia entry is not a proper historical source. Right? If you want to do your history essay, that's not where you go. That there are sources which are reliable, that are trustworthy, and there are sources which are not. There has been a huge problem with the distortion of history online in the last up to 20 years now, where different political movements for different reasons will distort historical facts, and doctor historical photographs. You know, there's plenty of examples of that. There's some researchers in Spain and in Hungary looking at the way in which the record of the Second World War and the record of the Francoist regime were being doctored by extreme right-wing groups, for example. So that allowing people to assess information which is there online in a critical way is an urgent matter. I don't think we can wait 25 years for it to seep down through the, you know, the curriculum. That's something that we need to proceed with carefully, but very quickly, I think, as well.
And in Insight, since this is one of the platform research initiatives now, is there other work going on within the organisation in this realm?
So already there are a range of different projects that are looking at cultural data sets, both historic and also contemporary. And I suppose the initiative is about bringing those together and maybe demonstrating the kind of the broad scope of cultural analytics and, you know, hopefully then developing further work. So, for example, we have some researchers working on Irish census data, so linking together information from census records to identify the same people and how families or how Irish society is changing over time. We also have researchers working on audio archives from places like the British Library. And again, these are really rich data sets. They require some quite complex machine learning methods to make use of them, to make them accessible for other people. And I think if you can demonstrate to people the, like I said, the scope of cultural analytics, everything from 19th century texts on, you know, public health to audio recordings of NASA's moon landings. You know, it's a really broad area, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of interesting work to be done.
Mm-hmm. As I think it was Mark Rowntree in a previous podcast, Inside Podcast, said, the past is unpredictable.
Yes. Yeah, that really struck me as well. Yeah. And sometimes the stuff we don't know about the past is actually quite powerful in influencing the present. I mean, some of the conversations we've been having with people in the School of Medicine and with people who work in public health has been very interesting in terms of meeting the same problem in different guises over the centuries. And sometimes we have to be reminded that not just that the problems occur, but the solutions have been worked out time and again. You know, so looking, say, at the language of people who oppose vaccination or are hesitant about vaccination in the past can inform us when we hear the same language occurring in the present. Okay, there's some very primal human fears being kind of orchestrated here, but also that in the past, through communicating in ways that meet people where they are, not using the scientific language, which is alienating, but in telling stories and in bringing it down to a human level, that you can actually communicate the value of vaccination. And we have evidence that this has worked in the past because vaccination becomes more and more widespread. So I think, you know, sometimes the past is incredibly depressing when you see patterns repeating. But one of the interesting things, for example, with the project on migration is how quickly sometimes populations who are seen as really alien and invasive, 20, 25 years later, they can be completely integrated. So I think that's the thing, that the cycles can recur, but also, you know, progress happens, solutions recur as well.
Thanks for joining us for episode 13. And for those of you who've been with us throughout the lockdown, we're delighted to have you. For anyone that hasn't, please go back into the archive. There's plenty of great stuff in there. We'll see you next week. This has been a Snoring Dog production on behalf of the Insight SFI Research Centre for Data Analytics.